We're on the record, continuing our study session.
Okay, thank you. Other questions about at the higher level before we get into the weeds? Okay. It may be helpful as you go back and review these materials that in make sure I have the reference right. Attachment C2 to the staff report goes and reviews kind of that process that the work group went through. It includes analysis that staff did on some of those barriers, and then summarizes the barriers that they came up with. So if that's helpful to go back and refresh on that, that material's there. You can also make these slides available if that's helpful. I restate that because I know with the work group, we kind of continually circled back to those barriers that they identified to kind of keep checking in on, are we addressing everything? Are we getting too far out of field and so forth? So that's there. There's additional in the C attachments, there's additional background information. There's the comparison matrices that we did with those comparable communities I mentioned around land use and parking requirements in particular. So if you really want to get into the weeds on those issues, there's the good comparative summary matrix on those. There's additional parking information and background. So there's a recent article out of Planning Magazine that I thought was really helpful for helping put into context parking in downtowns. And then there's some historical information from some of those parking studies that were done in Kingston. There's some retail projections for growth of commercial uses in the Kingston area there as well. And some excerpts from the Puget Sound Regional Council document they titled Planning for Whole Communities. The whole document is fascinating, but I included just two that really speak to the core issues around parking management and pedestrian-oriented design for downtown Kingston. And then the complete streets plan was not physically attached to the report because it's a substantial document itself and there's no changes to it. It's posted on the county's website. The URL is in the staff report. While the entire study is interesting, the conceptual design plans for all of the streets of downtown Kingston are in the appendices to that study. And so if you're interested in what the complete streets means as far as sidewalks and bike lanes and transit and green space and all of that sort of thing, those conceptual drawings are really fantastic for being able to picture that. So there's a lot of content there to be able to flesh out what we're talking about. Okay, so so to get into the weeds, I thought we'd walk through attachment A to the staff report, which is the amendments. Just what I'll do is, and you can tell me if you think this is useful or if there's another approach you'd like to take, but kind of just orient you to what each one of those amendments is so there's no question after tonight about what the intent of these are. What the intent of each amendment is. And then I'll highlight as we go some specific areas that might be of interest to think about that were debated amongst the work group or staff had various thoughts on. Would it be helpful if I scrolled through on the screen, or do you have all have it in front of you and we can just work together through it?
Yeah, I think if you just stopped at every blue line that represents the next.
Okay. So I'll do this on the screen. So in attachment A, there's an introduction to each section. This is not regulatory language. This is just information for the reader to help put things in context. So I wanted to clarify that for folks. Moving to attachment one, this is the multifamily design criteria in Kitsap County Code, Chapter 17.470. And this references some code that we're going to repeal in this amendment. So Amendment 1A here is to remove the reference to the what we're proposing to repeal and incorporate that language directly into the multifamily design criteria. So there's no substantive change here, just reorganizing content. So with 1A is part of that, 1B is recodifying or moving content. 1C is moving content. 1D is moving content. And then 1E is repealing Chapter 17.480, which is the Urban Village Center Design Criteria. These are the redundant criteria that were in county code. When we get into the design standards, you'll see where we've similarly inserted language that came out of 17.480 into the other set of Kingston design standards. So Amendment 2 is to revise and publish the what I'll call, for in shorthand, the Kingston Design Standards. The formal title is the Design Standards for the Community of Kingston. And so Amendment 2A here is to adopt the exhibit, which is the full document of design standards. And we'll walk through some of those key changes in a moment. 2B is to add those design standards to the appendix of Title 17, like we've done with all the other design standards this year in the clarifying edits amendment. Amendment 3 is to just update some internal references to the design standards. So 3A is to remove the reference to the repealed 17.480 set of design criteria for the Urban Village Center Zone. 3B is to update footnote references to the Kingston Design Standards now that they're in the appendix. And 3C is doing the same in another section of footnotes. So those are all organizational and clarifying amendments. Amendment 4 is to move some definitions from the Kingston Design Standards into Title 17 so that we're, the county has been trying to consolidate definitions into one section of Title 17 for a while, so this is part of that cleanup. There are some minor clarifications to these definitions, but no substantive refinement to these definitions, moving them into Title 17. So all of those are new definitions. So then the next section is around parking standards. So Amendment 5 defines the high capacity transit station area. Okay. And I'm going to jump to that map so you can see the map that goes along with this. Make sure I'm getting to the right spot. So this is the half mile radius around the ferry terminal. And on its edges it has some odd shapes because it is only needs to be within the urban growth area. So this is the urban growth boundary coming down along the shoreline, Washington Boulevard. And then over here, we cut it off so the half-mile circle didn't include across the estuary. And we cut it off at the intersection of West Kingston Road there. But this is the half-mile walk shed to the ferry terminal. So Amendment 6 is to revise the parking code in Title 17 around the location of parking facilities and on-street parking. So this adds some language or clarifies some language around joint use facilities and a parking agreement requirement. So there was previous language around an agreement, but it was pretty vague. And so for improved administration, we've as the department, come up with some more defined language around what that parking agreement needs to address. It doesn't stipulate the terms of the agreement, but how it's recorded and what it needs to cover. Also in this amendment is in this box is how we have formatted where the work group has proposed this language in blue. And in this case, we've kind of rewritten some of that and reorganized some of it and how we think it'll be administered a little bit more clearly. But in this particular case, we haven't tried to change the intent of what the work group is proposing. So here, it's primarily expanding the distance of off-site parking from 300 feet to 800 feet if you're within a high-capacity transit station area.
So it's your intent that these off-site parking agreements run with the land then?
Yes, but for both where the use is located as well as where the parking is provided. Yep.
Is there any opportunity for shared parking agreement where hours of operation were to come into play?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And you guys use the word straight line and main entrance. Straight line to me on a map really means radius, and
right.
The center of it is, okay.
Yes. Just to keep things really simple
right.
For folks.
Okay. Understood.
Yep.
And then has the Kingston group pushed back? I guess you said you've only heard from one of them so
right.
far.
Right.
I just think about street improvement, like sidewalk, curb, and gutter.
Right.
Because it says, and I understand the intent yep. overall at a 50,000-foot level for Kingston to improve its walkability.
Right. Yep.
But the idea could get pretty financially detrimental quickly.
Right.
And when I've got to add 800 feet of
absolutely.
Sidewalk.
Yep. And that's where those kind of market infrastructure barriers come into context here. There's another provision we'll get to in the design standards that the developer can defer those improvements by signing a no protest agreement for an improvement district with the county. So we can get to that. Where
okay.
they, in this case, where you have to provide that pedestrian connection to the parking, you could defer that, but still utilize this provision.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I should note that in these comment bubbles onto the side, we've tried to provide some context for the reader about the amendments where it seemed appropriate. So I won't go through every single detail on these amendments. Just trying to highlight the more significant ones. So here on page 11 of 34, this is the parking agreement, kind of spelling out the general terms of it for folks. And then maybe to get to your question a little bit, Commissioner Allen, the second section of this is around enforcement. That if it's violated, they're responsible for coming up with a solution that's suitable to the department.
So in downtown Kingston, in this area, are there existing surface lots then that are there?
There's a substantial number of surface lots.
Okay. Is that going to remain an allowed use?
Yes.
Okay. Because as the development and transition begins, typically surface parking lots are one of the first things that you
right.
want to get rid of.
Right.
Typically.
So we would anticipate that over time, if you have a shared parking agreement with a surface lot that is then later a development proposal in its own right, that you could get off-site parking somewhere else, arrange for off-site parking somewhere else. And so that's in particular where a parking management program becomes useful, is you could have an entity that then becomes more of a management function for finding, trying to arrange or those connections for folks, or providing a centralized parking facility at some point.
Put your mic on.
Turn your mic on.
In Port Angeles, there's a downtown business association that has a special parking benefit area that they manage on behalf of the city for downtown parking. Is that the kind of model you're looking at?
That's a model that could be used. Yeah. So if the landowners wanted to establish that structure and do it as a collective, they can do that. Or they could look to someone like the port or another entity to take on that management role.
Yeah. I need to plead legal naivety for a moment. If I had a shared off-site parking agreement with you, somebody with raw land that is currently being parked, mm-hmm. and you decided to develop, is what I negotiated and put into writing and on title with you now a cloud on your title that could cause me not to be able to develop?
Yes.
Until we clear it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So if I then can't find another alternative within 800 feet, I don't sign off that we don't have an agreement anymore, you're stuck. Because I need your parking and I won't release our agreement.
Yeah, and your entitlement was based on
right.
that parking agreement.
Right. So then in that case, if I wanted to redevelop my property, I would need to redevelop it and provide you the parking that we
if I
to
couldn't find another
at the same time, right? So I might need to, build a structure that provides that parking for your use as well as whatever use I'm building on that property.
And the devil's in the contract agreement between right. the two parties.
And so in this language, we've specified what for our purposes we want to have addressed, but in your agreement with whoever. You could address that future scenario, right, and have language that...
Should it come to light, yeah. I would have the right, or
so
you
that,
would have the right.
Right.
Okay.
So you're not completely deadlocked. There could be a mechanism for transition in the future.
Okay.
But that'd be up for you to
yeah,
negotiate.
Yeah, and I was just pitching the theoretical yeah. of somebody getting stuck, which
yeah,
then
absolutely.
You're back to hindering development. Okay.
Well, and also the complexity of the paper trail too on this, to the extent that development really kicks off in downtown Kingston, you know, your original parking agreement's replaced with a different one, it becomes hard to follow.
Well, and it could also provide stimulus for consolidation too.
Right. Yeah. Or just
thanks.
Yep. So on-street parking spaces, so this is the department has recommended this same outcome regarding off-street parking, but put it in the design in the design standards rather than in the parking chapter of code. But what would be allowed here is that for commercial uses, on-street parking in front of the parcel that the commercial use is being located on would count towards their minimum required parking. Not for residential and not anywhere else on the block, and as it's consistent with the complete streets plan. So if you look at the complete streets plan, there's on-street parking in front of some parcels and not in front of others. So this isn't completely equal to all parcels, available to all parcels, but it provides some flexibility consistent with the master plan of street frontages and on-street parking in the complete streets.
Yeah, I'm not seeing the limitation to the frontage because the language says the right-of-way adjacent to the lot. So that could be not just the front.
Okay. That it's intended to be what's fronting.
That's
a good point. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So Amendment 7 is around the number of parking spaces required. So to orient you to how this table works, so elsewhere we've had the work group's recommendations above and the department's recommendations below. In this case, we have them side by side. So the left two columns here is the existing content in Chapter 17-490. And the right two columns are two different versions of what would become the third column of this table, if that makes sense. So the department's recommendation is on the right in red. The work group's recommendation is in the middle in blue. And the way this column or this table is now intended to be used is that the county-wide parking requirement is in the second column. So if you're in Silverdale or Keyport or Manchester or wherever, that second column is what applies to you. It is modified by the columns to the right, and so in the DCD recommendation, this is for a high-capacity transit station area. So right now, if this is adopted, this would only apply to Kingston. But if there are future high-capacity transit station areas identified elsewhere in the county and designated, these parking standards would apply to those locations as well. Okay. So this is a global code that currently would only be implemented in Kingston.
Is the work group generally on board with the staff modifications?
I've only gotten the one response, and there wasn't any concern expressed there for this section. And what we've principally done here is just some rewording for the most case. Yeah. And so you'll generally see throughout the board here that in a high-capacity transit station area, the parking requirements are reduced, in some cases by half. Okay. Of note, for single-family residences, the garages would be counted towards parking spaces, whereas elsewhere in the county, they are not. And there's a presumption there that in an urban area, multi-unit development, that there would be some management associated with that. The example I provided to the work group was the condominium where my mother-in-law lives. Twice a year, they have a garage door open day where they have an inspection to make sure that you actually can park in your garage. But that's the condominium association that is managing that. So a little more flexibility with multifamily here. So depending on the unit size by number of bedrooms, the parking requirements are different. And again, parking's expensive. If you're a one bedroom or a studio unit, you know, you shouldn't have to pay or absorb the cost necessarily of extra parking. And there is a nuance here as well that I think is important to note. The current requirement elsewhere in the county is you have this half a space per unit that's on street or set aside. In our proposal, this is just set aside. And this ties back to the on street parking that we've talked about before. In the work group's discussions, they were willing to go along with counting commercial on street parking towards requirements, but the rest of on street parking should be managed on a district-wide basis and not committed towards residential use, is how they landed on the question.
So tell me about the set-aside. Where is it set-aside?
So the set-aside could be on-site or off-site. And the importance of a set-aside is that instead of having, you know, two spaces per unit, you have one, in this case, you have one and a half spaces per unit and a half a space set-aside. So that set-aside, let's just hypothetically say it's 10 spaces set aside, that if you have a mixed-use project, that could potentially become a shared-use set of parking that's based on time for commercial occupants in your building and the residents in your building, right? So you're more efficiently using that parking, meaning that there's a car in that spot more hours out of the day than having lots of vacant parking spaces during the day or during the night. So part of providing that flexibility is the set-aside could just be for the residents, or it could be for someone who's willing to consider an agreement or shared use with a commercial use, could be used more efficiently.
But they'd actually have to have, you have to set aside the physical space for a half a
You have to build
a space,
build
but you
a
don't
space.
Have to develop it? Is that,
no,
trying to get
sorry, it. You have to build it, but it wouldn't be designated to any particular unit. It's a shared pool of parking
okay.
for the project is what it's meant to be. Yeah. So then it provides then more flexibility for the overall project in the block and the neighborhood potentially.
So half space per unit in a bigger development is going to be a pretty big cost for the developer then, right? Especially if they can no longer count on-street parking. That's a significant change.
Well, so so the on-street is a change. If they're doing smaller units with fewer bedrooms, they have fewer parking, less parking requirements. And then we'll get to this in a moment, but there's also more flexibility in reduction of parking. And there's a lot more flexibility in what you can do to reduce your parking requirements. So this is, becomes the baseline, and then there's more flexibility okay. built in here. So scrolling down, for a lot of the commercial uses, based on what we've looked at for other communities, most of those are dropping to one space per 400 square feet for lots of different commercial uses as a general standard. One note of difference is for this mortuaries, funeral homes, and crematoriums. The work group had recommended reducing the parking requirement. The department thought that, you know, that those are very high demand uses. Probably not going to locate in downtown Kingston, but we were recommending not to change that. So those are the baseline standards. So then this is the deviations from the required spaces. So. And here we're trying to achieve the same intent as the work group, but making it applicable to the high-capacity transit station areas and fleshing out in a little bit more detail what some of the flexibility is. So the current standard is that you can, with a director's decision, increase your required parking by 10% or reduce it by 25%. With a director's decision, up to 25% by director's decision. Over those thresholds, so if you want to reduce it by more than 25%, it's a hearing examiner decision. What we're recommending here is that in a high-capacity transit station area, a reduction greater than 25% would become a director's decision. And it would have to be based on a traffic impact analysis, and that they could, as a replacement for parking, they can provide car share programs, shuttles, regional transit passes or subsidies. They could record lease and deed restrictions to limit the number of total vehicles owned by tenants, participate in public parking management program or district, implement an alternative transportation management plan, which would include things like, you know, bicycle parking, bicycle maintenance facilities, you know, their proximity to transit and groceries and other things, or substantially replace on-site surface parking with underground or structured parking. So that's one of those incentives to reduce the amount of surface parking. So there's a lot of flexibility built in here, and you can demonstrate transportation needs are being met by other means than a vehicle in the high-capacity transit station area only.
Do you have any feel for how much the Kitsap Transit lot at George's Corner is being used? Is that filled up, or is that MTD, any idea?
I don't know specifically, no. I know they've modified some of their routes going into Kingston, and they're expanding park and rides into the passenger-only ferry service. So I believe it's fair to say their expectations are that ridership's going to go up and that they're trying to collect those riders from outside of downtown Kingston and bring them in via transit, which is a lot like the model used on Bainbridge Island, where the neighborhoods off-island are served by transit to the ferry terminal.
I do see a lot of people getting on buses from the ferry. I don't know where all those buses go, but people do seem to be taking them.
And some of this language in particular is adapted from a King County Metro model code. So, over in King County, they've gotten far more aggressive in parking reduction. We haven't adopted their numbers. We've tried to use numbers that are pedestrian oriented, but are reflective of where we're at in Kitsap County today. In the coming years, but here trying to provide the flexibility that would allow a lot more creativity and alternatives to vehicles. So now transitioning to the use table. So Amendment 8 is just revising the urban village center zone. So as you know, there's a larger review and update underway for the zoning use table that has excluded the UVC zone from it because of this amendment. So this is kind of the companion puzzle piece to that. And that's because we were working on this ahead of that other project. So in only the UVC column, I've included the whole table for completeness here, but only in the UVC column are the changes. And in blue are the work group's recommendations, and in red would be the department's recommendations. So accessory dwellings and living quarters would become permitted. Duplexes would become permitted and not required in administrative CUP. Single-family detached dwellings would become permitted to clarify that it would have to meet minimum density. Guest houses are permitted, which are temporary residences attached to businesses. Some commercial uses are permitted or modified, so like auto parts stores are permitted, but automobile rentals, the work group, so this is the one maybe to highlight. The work group recommended automobile rentals becoming an administrative CUP because from the discussions at the time they made this recommendation, they were concerned with, fleets of vehicles or car share vehicles kind of being inconsistent with a pedestrian-oriented downtown, right? But as the department looked at this further, the footnote limits it to 8 vehicles on site, and the intent of that was that then the fleet would be stored off-site somewhere more appropriate and would be shuttled in to the pickup location. And so what we've done is we've recommended for this to stay the way it is, that a rental location with 8 vehicles is really not a significant impact, but we've clarified the footnote that goes with this to clarify the off-site location of the fleet.
I thought we were never going to have any more footnotes in use codes, right? We're going to get rid of those dogs, but not all the way.
There's going to have to be a little bit of a transition, because even as we are doing the use table update right now, we're realizing that there are some of the footnotes that are attached to the dimensions and density table, which we're looking at getting into next year. So I think it'll be iterative steps in getting rid of all of them.
So I won't go through every single line here, but some commercial uses like boat marine supply stores for Kingston with the marina there, prohibited currently in downtown closest to the marina, probably should be a permitted use. Espresso stands, likewise, probably should be a permitted use in downtown.
Is the one that's there now, that's on port property, is that why it's there then?
Might be. I haven't looked into it, but that's the neighborhood commercial zone instead of the UVC zone. So that might be the difference. So like innovations, like research laboratories, were prohibited, but if someone wants to set up shop in Kingston. I think that captures most of the important changes there. Yeah. Oh, maybe one clarification. So I know in the use table update, there might be changes to these storage categories, but for downtown Kingston, there was the work group specifically didn't want to see more self-storage, mini-storage type of spaces taking up downtown space, but they recognized businesses could need indoor storage spaces that if they were not integral to their primary location, could be prohibited under the current code. So that's what this indoor storage permitted use is intended to address in downtown. Okay, so that's uses. This is the clarification about rental cars being off-site for the fleet. Okay, so then the sub-area plan, I won't go into a lot of detail here, but we've, as I mentioned, we've retired some policies that have been completed. We've reorganized some, so there's a lot of side notes kind of explaining why something moved to somewhere else. So I think those are self-explanatory. One policy I want to mention is number 51. So policy 51, the update the design standards to address ongoing public input. This is the one that got some clarification back from a work group member. So when the department read that, we thought that was okay, do an update, and then we're done. But the intent behind this policy was to do that, but also to continue to monitor feedback and adapt the design standards as necessary. So taking that into consideration, we wrapped that into how we revised policy 50. Which was originally around explore new provisions to support redevelopment in Kingston, so redevelopment code, which we think we're addressing here in this amendment. So we modified this one to kind of periodically monitor redevelopment activity and ensure code provisions are doing what they're supposed to do. And so we wrapped in and the design standards to achieve the vision for downtown Kingston and public feedback. So we've tried to incorporate that intent here, that we're continuing to periodically monitor and collect feedback. So I don't anticipate in the future, I'm not sure what the cycle would be, but we would be seeking community feedback. So those are the changes to policies. So then the next section would be to get into some of the key highlights of the design standards.
Can you real quick, sorry to interrupt.
Yep.
In Kingston Policy 50, actually right above that, Land Use Goal 16.
Yes.
The reference says, compatible with Kingston's current design. Is that language that is a bit ambiguous without a reference?
It could be. So here we relocated a policy language without editing. So if feedback from the commission is that this is an area for further clarification, we'd be happy to help address that.
I think we should at least make a note of that in the sense that my instinct was to write in the margin, which is, with a question mark.
Yes. Yep.
Well, seeing that there's some fairly detailed plans associated with this area, you know, reference to some of that, you know, might be a better,
okay,
better approach. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you and I, based on mostly you, hours and hours and hours of looking at other documents that do relate, I think it's as simple as referencing what that means.
Yep.
Yeah, we can point to something more specific.
Yeah, I just want to tip somebody to go, oh, but Kingston's ugly right now. Why would we, right? What are we referring to?
Right. That's good. Yep. Thank you. Okay, so for the design standards, there's a lot of revisions, and I'm not going to go through all of them by far. I want to highlight just a few. So excuse me for scrolling and jumping here a little bit. So applicability, this was a really important one to the work group. So as I mentioned before, applicability originally could be interpreted as everything. Every remodel or addition would then require the entire property to come up to standards. And to help with that idea of transition, of adapting and reusing existing buildings and parcels without complete redevelopment over time, we've clarified applicability, and the departments come up with what we think is a little bit more specific language, but along the same intent of what the work group came up with. So like in Silverdale and some other of our design standards, there's a 50% threshold now, and it's of the assessed building value. So if you're doing an addition and it's the value of that addition is less than 50% of the current assessed building value, you don't have to comply with the existing building doesn't have to comply with the design standards. The new stuff does. And if you're over that 50% threshold, then the entire site needs to comply. And that over 50% is over a 3-year period. So there's some specificity in here about that. So you can't just kind of serially try to skirt it every year. And then the other part of applicability here is that single-family residences are not exempt. So previously they were, but also they were prohibited use, or detached single-family residences were prohibited use. And so to clarify, we've added some specificity about which sections of the design standards would apply to a single-family residence, duplex or accessory dwelling unit, so that you're not trying to figure out through this really extensive design standards and all this commercial and multifamily stuff what is relevant and what's not. So we've tried to create more specificity here for what would be. The value of applying some of the standards to single-family residents is to maintain the overall intention for downtown being pedestrian-oriented and maintaining consistent character along streetscapes. So orientation of buildings to the front edge, street furniture, street trees, front edge improvements, and those sorts of things to be consistent regardless of what the development is. Along that street frontage had a lot of value, so the work group was agreeable to clarify what those standards are. So the next one I'm going to jump to is the frontage, the orientation to the street. So this was one that was a bit confusing to implement previously. So the setback of new construction no more than 15 feet from the roadside edge was the original language. And what the roadside edge was undefined and unclear. And is it the more rural road standard that might exist in Kingston without a sidewalk or even a shoulder? Or is it to the edge of the right-of-way? That wasn't clear. The work group came up with a kind of limited revision to this to be kind of the front lot line. But the department has recommended a different approach to the same ends. So we've tried to do some assumed calculations here that if your setback is 15 feet and your sidewalk should be 12, then from the right-of-way edge, the building should be no more than 3 feet. set back from the right-of-way edge. Folks can debate the number, but the framework is to try to get it to a very clear definition from a location that everyone can agree with. So the right-of-way edge would become the baseline to measure from. And so I'm really interested to hear the public's feedback in particular about that. My feeling is that we're trying to achieve the same ends by measuring from a more
We had the same sort of problems we had in Silverdale by farmland, and that is people redevelop where they're going to have to, what they thought were parking, they're going to lose that parking, it's going to have sidewalks. Is that the kind of problem?
So we'd like to avoid that type of problem, and with the complete streets plan, we have a template that people can base design from. Public Works has said that they need to do some additional level of design so that particular vertical elevation control can be built into individual frontage improvements. But the horizontal placement is fairly clear in the current complete streets. And there's other provisions here where if additional right-of-way is needed, that the building could be set back further for sidewalk construction and so forth. And so there are some exceptions to the setbacks here where greater setbacks are required for the complete streets plans or public safety, like turning radiuses, where public spaces are incorporated into front yards, where there's some sort of larger master plan that creates a cohesive unity consistent with the overall downtown Kingston, and for single-family dwellings and duplexes where parking can't be rear-loaded from the alleys like we talked about earlier, there's an additional setback for carports and garages so that the pedestrian-oriented occupied space of buildings is more fronting the street rather than the car-oriented garages.
So was there discussion about, because I understand that, bringing the building faces closer to the sidewalks, that's a great planning tool and that sort of thing. It works really well if your ground space, your ground level space is commercial. But if you're residential, then maybe not so much.
Right.
3 feet from the sidewalk. So was there discussion
right.
about that?
Yes. So this table distinguishes the pedestrian-oriented street frontages that are designated, right, with commercial intention for that first floor, has the 3-foot setback. And for the other streets in the design districts, it's a 10-foot setback. So if you're a multifamily that doesn't have commercial and you're outside those designated streets, or you're single-family detached or attached, then your setback is 10 feet.
Okay, but I guess even so, on these streets, the department's recommending on the designated pedestrian-oriented commercial streets, I think we heard some suggestions that maybe the word commercial be removed so that
right.
residential would be allowed at least to start.
Right.
I guess then you are looking at dwelling units that are 3 feet from the sidewalk. And requiring that.
Yes.
So the question is why?
Yeah. Well, so for those specific streets, the long-term intention is that those would be commercial spaces. I guess how do you do that and maintain it as pedestrian-oriented store frontage in the future while having a residential use in the interim period. And it seems to me it's kind of binary. You either set back the whole thing or have it set front forward.
I think your assumption, though, is that we're going to have a residential unit that will just be transformed into a commercial unit with no change. The house is going to be the commercial building. I assume that's the assumption. If you're going to redevelop, you can always move forward.
Right.
It's So that's the assumption built into this. Right. We're going to take the residential unit, we're going to make it the commercial building.
That, I think the assumption is that you have a multi-floor structure, right, with residential above, and that that first floor could be residential initially, but it would be commercial. And the design, the existing design standards have a very clear expectation that those commercial uses are right up to the sidewalk. And so they're trying, the intention here was to try to maintain that same expectation while providing more flexibility for the occupancy of that space on an interim basis. And I realize that for the residential dweller, that might be close.
Well, I guess it's one way to create affordable housing.
One analog to this is in the French Quarter in New Orleans, where you do have a lot of single-family residences that are right on the sidewalk. And what it does is it just changes the character of the housing. It's not conventional forward-looking housing. The design turns inward.
Well, Dave, the last thing we want to have is the French Quarter in Kingston.
That's also a chicken and egg kind of dynamic, too.
Right.
So please study this, and I welcome all your thoughts and suggestions on it. So moving on to open space, I've generally laid out the increased flexibility for off-site open space. So this is page 21. So in open space and landscaping, this kind of lengthy section is all about that off-site open space and landscaping. So I'll let you read that. It includes very similar language about the agreement that we talked about with parking, and took a lot of that same language and adapted it here. And again, the intention being to put what it could be on a very small lot, a very minuscule amount of landscaping, to collectively better use to benefit downtown and make a small site potentially more viable for actual development. So on page 29, the bottom of the page here is about the driveways and access to properties. So there was existing language here about alleys and a preference for alleys. In a prioritized order, that access would be from the rear of the parcel from alleyways, right? So that language is existing. And this is where we've adopted that map that designates alley locations. The Public Works has agreed to work on some alley standards at some point for this, so it can be further more clearly implemented. But the prioritization always is from the rear, and so that only applies to a few blocks in the UVC zone, and then there's preferences for from a lesser traveled roadway and from adjacent parcels. I can jump to the map.
Peter, will there be a, or can I recommend there should be a link to the map right there? I'm not seeing a URL jump like you're about to do.
Right, I'll work on that.
Okay.
See if it can be put in there, but it's in the appendices. So that would be the alley plan for Kingston, okay. And it only goes mid block because that's the extent of the design district boundary between second and third.
So Peter, I'm just going to do a time check here because we're 2 hours into our three.
Okay.
And I do have a hard stop at 8:30.
Okay. Yep. It looks like I only have three more to highlight to you, and then we'll move on to the site-specific amendment. Okay. Thank you for the time check. Now getting into buildings. So I'll zoom in a little bit here. So on page 40 is the new language about the first floor of the pedestrian-oriented commercial street frontages. So this is the implementing language that then references the map. So it says those shall be built for commercial use or eventual conversion to commercial occupancy along the street frontage. These commercial spaces may initially be used for residential use. So we've intentionally tried to leave it fairly general, but I welcome your feedback on the idea, because definitely there was disagreement. The work group debated this and as a group decided that they should let the market do this and not regulate it. One we'll highlight for public feedback as well.
And could you just state for the record again that this is, there's that section in the old UVC that January 1 of this year was removed, the mixed use requirement. And so in reference to a smaller, I'm going to use the wrong language, right? But so a smaller section of the map,
yes.
Not everything behind Village Green. We're now referring to a...
Right. Yeah, so to summarize, in 2018, we did away with a provision like this that was global across the entire UVC zone. And now what we're recommending is to kind of bring the idea back, but for a much smaller specific area.
And again, the opportunity here to be able to do a link to a map, because anybody that's looking at this is probably thinking about their own parcel.
Yep. Yep. Thank you.
And I guess the one thing that does trouble me though is the vagueness of what a commercial standard is. As if I was a builder coming in, what would that mean? What would be the dimensions? I typically know that in these scenarios with multi-use, the ground floor space is you know has taller ceilings and has bigger window space. I mean there's some certain hallmarks of what or commercial standards is, but as a builder, I would have no idea what you were talking. I mean, want criteria.
It's written today, I could just frame it with metal studs instead of wood studs and go, well, that's what commercial means to me. Mm-hmm. And that's not where you want to be.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Some feedback on the work group was that if you're doing multifamily, it's commercial, essentially commercial construction. Out of the gate, right?
But then we could also get back into the three or more units. We could get into the 4,000+ square feet that requires a stamp. But either way, we have none of that information here.
All right. So as you read through this more carefully, I'd appreciate if you've got some clarifying. That would be helpful. So then two more. So building height. So to simplify things, we've proposed this into a table. So maximum building height. For Old Town, this goes from currently 35 feet to 45 feet. And again, the entire UVC zone is 45. And so where the design district overlaps, it dropped to 35 currently. And we're proposing to just bring it back up to the base zone, 45 feet. In the maps, Appendix C1 to the staff report, there's a map that shows all of the heights of the base zoning and the design district, and so you can kind of see the whole lay of the land for heights. The Village Green currently is 45 feet. Interestingly, the base zoning is 35. So it's a reverse trend there. The design district raised the height. And for the Lindvog commercial area, which is the commercial zone, the base height's 35. The design district height currently is 35. But we're proposing for Kingston to increase it to 45. It's surrounded most predominantly by 45 and up to 55 foot height zones. And again, that map will show you those references. There's also a minimum number of stories, which is a little bit of a change.
Oh, before you move on,
okay, yes.
Just in the Old Town District, you're proposing 45 feet with a step back for
there,
the
yes.
upper stories.
Yep.
Does that address the view issues that folks had?
In part, yes. And also in part that the portion of Old Town and Waterfront is kind of in the, essentially the bowl, the bottom of the bowl that is Kingston. Mm-hmm. And so the folks up the northwestern slope are looking out over that, and they have building heights of 45 feet. To the south, I guess it is the Village Green District, which currently has 45-foot height limits. And so the more of the view impacts might come from the Lindvog commercial area, which is already set quite a far back from what most folks consider the primary view objective about towards the water.
Yeah.
So we'll be looking for more public feedback about those.
Well, and that's I like the device itself of the setback. It gets rid of some of that canyon impact that
right.
you can get from the walkability and
right.
the street experience. So
yes, and the increased height in part is, consistent with what is surrounding this, but it also helps make some of the parking that we're trying to incentivize to be underground or in structure or under building a little bit more viable by providing the opportunity for a few more units or space in a fourth floor of a building. So minimum number of stories. The original language was focused around maximum number of stories, and so building height, kind of takes care of that. And however many stories you want to fit into that is up to you. But the minimum number of stories is proposed here. So for commercial buildings, it's two stories in Old Town and Village Green, one story in the Lindvog commercial zone, because that's a little bit more larger spaces. And then for mixed use and multifamily buildings, it's two floors across the board minimum. And then the upper story setback. So the language for that is the last one I'll highlight, and then we'll move on to our last amendment for the night. So on page 46 is the language. So upper story setback was already an optional element. So like in the way these design standards work is here, for example, you have to do three or four out of a list of options. So it was an optional thing. Here, an upper story setback is required for any building portion of a building over 35 feet. So specifically to help address some view issues and to maintain the pedestrian scale from the street. So that's the last one I wanted to highlight in the design standards. There's a lot more all throughout it, mostly clarifying and consistency type of stuff. And look forward to your feedback on some of those items we began to talk about tonight. Okay, so we will transition back to another amendment. This is a...
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have been involved with this project to some extent over the years, and to make sure in a quasi-judicial proceeding that I am not in any way involved with claims of appearance of fairness violations, I'm going to recuse myself from any participation in this specific, and I'm going to step down from the podium during discussion.
Okay. Is this our final topic for the evening?
It is.
Can we release Mr. Shattuck if he wants to go home?
Okay. Thank you.
Happy holidays, Richard.
Is there any logistical issue with quorum related to decisions that needed to be made this evening with Commissioner Shattuck stepping down?
So we're not asking for any decisions tonight?
Thank you.
Yeah, so I think we're fine. All right, so all the previous amendments we discussed were county sponsored. This one is an application from the JWJ group, and the applicant is here. Actually, I can ask you to step forward if you want. I'll do kind of an overview and then give the applicant an opportunity to say a few things, and then both of us are available to answer questions. And like I said, this one, we're still preparing the staff report, so you'll be getting that in a bit. So this is located in the Silverdale Unincorporated Urban Growth Area in Dickey Road. So it's west of Highway 3 and located, I'll show you in a moment, kind of between Anderson Hill Road and Newberry Hill Road. And the site is large. It's 138 acres. The request for zoning is currently it's zoned industrial and industrial within the mineral resource overlay. And the request is to change that to urban low density residential at 5 to 9 dwelling units per acre and neighborhood commercial at 10 to 30 dwelling units per acre. The revised proposal that we have now is received a determination of non-significance. And our department recommendation on this is pending the completion of the staff report. So just wanted to give you a little bit of history on the development of this amendment, like I did for the Kingston amendment. So this did come in 2018 as an application for 108 acres. And there was one proposal at that time for urban low density residential designation. It was withdrawn during the 2018 process. The original 108 acres is the red area that's outside of this black box. So it was the area west of the black box was what was submitted in 2018. In 2019, the revised application came in for the entire red area, which is 138 acres. It originally had three alternatives proposed with varying amounts of requested urban low density residential and neighborhood commercial. So three alternatives with essentially different amounts of neighborhood commercial in them. In reviewing this, the department determined that a CEPA determination of significance was likely. The issues here are listed, population growth capacity, exceeding adopted planning targets for the entire UGA, employment growth capacity falling below the adopted planning targets for the UGA, reduction of industrial land inventory, urban service deficiencies, so transportation, sewer, and some others, and land use compatibility with adjacent areas. So based on that and under our code, the applicant has the ability to revise their proposal. That was done. The revision was for the same area, 138 acres, with one proposal that includes both urban low and neighborhood commercial. This comparison map on the left is the current zoning. So industrial is the, kind of aqua color here. And the mineral resource overlay is hatched. So in the dark black outline is the proposed area. So this portion, the southwestern portion, has the mineral resource overlay. And then the northern portion and the eastern portion are just industrial currently. And the request is for kind of this middle core area to be urban low density residential with neighborhood commercial in kind of three areas around that in fronting Dickey Road. Okay. The proposal also includes a road connection from connecting Dickey Road to Willamette Meridian. And Willamette Meridian is the urban growth area boundary here, as well as in purple, some non-motorized connections in the county's non-motorized plan has kind of a main spine, north-south spine of a non-motorized system generally running through this area. The exact location isn't specified, so the work on that.
So refresh my memory, urban low is how many dwelling units per acre?
5 to 9.
5 to 9.
Yep. So this is conceptually non-motorized connections. This is a larger aerial image of the area, so it's a little bit hard to see in this, but there's a slight red line surrounding the proposed area. It includes this area down here and the core up here. So just to orient you to what surrounds this, I'll go counterclockwise. Apex Airport is to the north west here. So north is to the right of this map. There is industrial development on the western side here on Willamette Meridian. There is an active mine to the south, sand and gravel mine, with a rock crusher and asphalt. Concrete. Is it asphalt? Okay. Yeah, an asphalt batch plant here. And the mine operator expects to expand into this 40 acres here to the west that they own. And the anticipated operation duration of 40 to 50 years is what he explained to me.
Can we get at some point for the next meeting a better outline of the subject property?
Yes.
on this?
And then to the southeast, there's the county solid waste facility here for the Silverdale area and the Humane Society Animal Shelter. And then Silverdale Elementary is located down here, as well as I believe it's the district's kitchen facility and their bus facility is located here. There's some additional residential development that's happening along the eastern side of Dickey Road. And there's two phases of a subdivision that have been developed here, and currently, I think, under construction is the third phase to the north, outside of the UGA. It previously was in the UGA, but the UGA retracted in this area in 2016. So that's the surrounding area. If there's any questions for me, I'm happy to answer those now, or I can hand this over to Levi Holmes, the applicant, and he can share some information with you, and then we can have more of a discussion.
Go for it.
So Levi, I have your additional images up here as well.
Okay, great. Yeah. So a little background just about the site. So this was permitted, I believe, in 1980. This north section of the mine, it was an addition to what's labeled as the active mine on the screen. And it was mined out, I believe the activity stopped in about the early 90s, and it's been dormant as a site ever since. It was operated by Port Orchard Sand and Gravel, and former Ace Paving operated the site to the south, and they kind of had a partnership together. Since the early 90s, and I'll point to this map because it's right next to me, but this part here, this is 80 acres. And this is another 30 acres here. This is the part that was part of the mine. This 30 acres down here is a separate project that I'll talk about. It's not part of the original mine. So anyway, the project technically has an active mining permit. And the main reason for that is the owners, it's been too expensive to reclaim, you know, 108 acres of site and do all the things that's required by Department of Ecology. So they've just kind of kept that permit active. And kept their bond active for the time being, looking for an opportunity to redevelop. There hasn't really been much demand for industrial land now that they've extracted all the minerals. The site down below the 30 acres in the late 2000s had a permit to do an industrial park and office complex. And they got an active site development activity permit. They put in all the infrastructure, did the grading. My understanding is they got basically to the point that all they had to do is pave the driveways to finalize the SDAP, and then they abandoned the project. due to market conditions, and they've never revisited it, and the permit since expired. So that's sort of half developed, that 30-acre piece. There's some critical areas on the site, actually on throughout the entire site, that have kind of restricted some of the areas of development as well. And there's also a 250-foot-wide power line easement owned by Bonneville that runs through that lower 30-acre piece. So that's a little bit of the history of the site. And so we had the opportunity with the comp plan amendment process in 2018 originally to do a site-specific rezone inside the urban area to a residential use. And we just thought this was a great site to find a way to make something happen on it, since it's been dormant for so long. And also in the process, we'll be able to reclaim the site. So there's a provision in the state code that allows Department of Ecology to hand over jurisdiction of the reclamation to Kitsap County, and they would incorporate that with a site development permit so that that happens together at the same time. And basically, my understanding of the purpose of that is so that you don't reclaim the entire site, which would include bringing in topsoil, replanting everything just to tear it all back off, or a lot of it during the development process, and then put back what you need to on the parts that are landscaped, and so just allow doing that all at one time. So moving forward, kind of a thought on this, as Peter mentioned, we started with urban low, and we ran into some issues staying consistent with the comprehensive plan and keeping things in balance. So we came up with this urban low and neighborhood commercial mix. And got a drawing here. Maybe Peter, if you can put that one up as well. So this is a land plan that Lawrence Kumar did. He's the land planner that did the Seabrook community, if you're familiar with that on the Washington coast. But what he did was he basically said, with these two zones mixed together, and again, to kind of orient you, this lower 30 acres would be neighborhood commercial. This north 40 would be neighborhood commercial. This section in the middle would be urban low, and this piece here would be neighborhood commercial. And that mix gets kind of the balance on the numbers with the land capacity analysis where they need to be to stay in balance. But it also creates some unique opportunity to allow some commercial uses in this zone as well, not just for this community, which could be a number of units, but also the surrounding residential, which you can actually see quite a bit of, especially on the east side of Dickey Road. And so some of those uses that could be in here could be a restaurant, coffee shop, retail, brew pub, a number of different senior convalescent home type uses. Just a little quick background, our company does actually a lot of different development in Kitsap County. We've been doing things since 1987, and we've built a lot of assisted living facilities or been involved in them. We did Montclair Park in Paulsbo, which is on Lincoln, 109 units. We did a skilled nursing conversion to assisted living in Bremerton called Wellington Park. We also are involved in the large one on Clear Creek and Greaves Road that's being developed right now next to the Trail Shopping Center. There's a large 8-acre parcel being developed for a senior. And then we've done some commercial office buildings, some medical. We did the Tremont Medical Center. We're involved in that. And then a number of residential communities. So this is a really great place where we, rather than segregating all these different things, could bring some of those together. And the neighborhood commercial zone is probably one of the best zones I think that the county has. And I don't think a lot of people really know about it or utilize it. But from a raw development standpoint, there's more flexibility in the minimum lot size, maximum lot size, in the allowed uses and setbacks. Just really allows you to be able to do a neighborhood that could have a lot of mix of uses and residential types, building scaling, and bring it all together. So basically on the site that Lawrence came up with, what the vision was is the areas in dark red would be your higher density or higher scaled buildings. And so it kind of straddles the urban low neighborhood commercial line. But you could do, let's say, multifamily on the urban low side and some mixed-use buildings on the neighborhood commercial side, but kind of a denser core. And the building scaling as far as just the size of them, the height, and the density would kind of scale off. So then you get to the orange section, and that's getting lower, and then to the yellow section, which would be the lowest scale. And it's going to be hard to see from where you're standing. Next time I'll bring a PowerPoint. I'm a protesting millennial, so I don't use technology as well as I'm supposed to. So I'll just hold this one down a little lower so you can see, but maybe to the side. But basically, the idea would be, so like number one here, this is showing kind of a...
What's that?
Oh.
Sorry, that was rotated the wrong way,
okay.
So I won't show that one.
So there's some kind of higher scale buildings. This could be mixed use or commercial, and then some, you know, housing with detached garages or cottages kind of in the back. It could also be extra parking. And another version, sorry, Dave, is this one over here. So these are labeled number one. And again, kind of a higher density core here with some parking. So both number ones could be in this area in red down below. Moving up, number two, this is kind of a big, could be community center, commercial space, or could be an apartment building kind of surrounded by, again, some single family housing, or some of these are detached or attached, sorry, with some cottages or parking in the back. And that section could be this area right here. And again, this is just kind of conceptual, but and then number three is kind of a take on how this core could be utilizing the man-made sediment ponds that are already there, because they are very large. They're big enough you could kayak on, or people have been swimming in them, and they're pretty large. So utilizing them, because it would be very expensive to try to get rid of them or do something else. And so that's kind of this core here. And then lastly, this is kind of a section just of kind of in the urban low, again, getting to more traditional single family housing. You know, these are showing alley loaded units. And that would be kind of in this yellow section over here.
I have a question.
Yes.
In that last section that you talked about, there's no, which way is north on the map?
North would be to the right.
To the right, okay. So on the southern side that abuts the active mine.
Yes.
It has the batch plant. Is there an asphalt batch plant on there?
Correct.
Okay. I'm concerned that you're looking at single family residential on that face of the, because I see great buffering with what looks to be open space.
Yes.
On many of the other, kind of buffering from the animal shelter, the solid waste facility, but adjacent to the active mine, I don't see that type of buffering.
Sure. So let me just put this one up here a little bit better, because part of it is the way that it's scaled. I was trying to keep it in line with the parcel lines. But the plan would be that we would definitely keep a good buffer there from the active mine as well, probably berming it up and then planting it as well. There's not really much natural vegetation due to the activity of the mine. The parcels down here, so these are zoned industrial. There's a house on one of them, mobile home, but there's a Strawberry Creek headwaters are right here. Large wetland here, and then Strawberry Creek kind of continues up. So I don't really foresee anything kind of up here getting developed. I think it'd be very expensive, hard to get access to. So you're going to have a nice natural buffer there. So really we're just talking kind of about this boundary here.
Yeah.
And then there's a stream on the other side as well that goes, and it actually kind of goes out right here. So I don't know how much of this parcel the mine will actually be able to cut into because of that stream. I don't know what their buffers will be. So really we're just talking this boundary here, and our plan would definitely be to have a very good buffer there. Another thing is the mine is this site. They only went down about 20 or 30 feet. Which is fairly minimal. The mine on the other site is very deep. So when you stand up here on the site with no buffer right now, you can barely hear anything because of how deep it is. It's kind of a natural noise barrier. But obviously putting a residential community here, we want to be very sensitive to having good buffers so that it doesn't affect the neighborhood.
Yeah.
A couple other things. And some of this is kind of on a conceptual level, but the land capacity analysis that the county ran comes up with, there's 60 acres of urban low, but it's coming up with 25 net developable, and 78 acres of neighborhood commercial, but only 31 net. So 138 acres total seems like a very big project, but when you take out all of the critical areas, the steep slopes and setbacks and all the different things the land capacity analysis does, it's actually quite a bit less that's net developable that then runs the density calculations. Let's see here. I think the main reason we really wanted to take this project on is because we're finding that there's not a high demand for industrial land in Kitsap County, especially in central Kitsap. Skia has kind of the best place for industrial opportunities. They've got a lot of extra capacity there and unique transportation hubs and ways to supply the industrial land. And just the fact that this is kind of sat dormant for 30 years without really anything being done on it when it's effectively been mined out. And the other parcel getting abandoned kind of midway through, it just seemed like a good opportunity to take this process and say, can we find a better use for this, given its location to kind of the central core of Silverdale? And just being in the development business, we're finding it's really hard to find available land without major complications to develop them anymore. And we really need housing in Kitsap. So I think it's a great opportunity to be able to provide that with this amendment.
So thank you, Levi. So as you can see, we've provided you with maps in the SEPA checklist. The staff report will have a lot more analysis around the topics that we've brought up. One question I had for you tonight or as follow-up is, you know, what questions do you have related to this proposal that we might be able to incorporate into the staff report for you?
One question I have, will the public hearing on January 7th be set up to address this as a comprehensive plan amendment as well as?
Yes,
the staff report. As a separate hearing? Or?
No, we have to process all of this as a batch, but this will be one of the amendments in the hearing.
But we would only be hearing the zoning change, not the development proposal.
Correct. That is an important clarification. Yes.
I going forward, I'd like to get a little more specificity on the where the uses are on the active mine site. Where's the batch plant? Where's the just to give a sense and a scale to, you know, kind of. Because this parcel is surrounded by some pretty intense uses. So that would be something I'd like to evaluate.
Okay.
Has the county used as a condition of approval type of device notification on the face of the title about surrounding potentially incompatible uses in zoning?
So that is required for mine sites for future subdivisions. So I can't remember exactly what the distance is. I think it's 600 feet, but that might be a little bit different. So when this gets subdivided, there would be notices to those parcels within at least that distance of the mine.
Is there a public notification requirement or process related to the rezone, or is it just expected that when it goes before the Planning Commission and then the commissioners, those being public open meetings, that is in fact that opportunity?
Right, great question. So for site-specific amendments, we do direct mailings to adjacent properties.
Now we're only referring to this as a rezone, right?
That's all it is.
Correct.
On our docket.
Yes.
Okay. But finish your sentence. I'm sorry about public notice.
Sorry. So we directly mail adjacent properties and we post signs on site, and then it gets included in all our broadcast announcements. But yes, it is described as a rezone. The densities are published in those notices. But yes, it's not a development proposal.
Okay.
So, Peter, will the development proposal be subject to any kind of public process in and of itself? Is it an ACUP, or what would be the process for that?
So that's an excellent question. I don't know
you know, it depends on how it's proposed. The zones, I actually haven't looked at that specifically, so Levi, you might have looked at that more.
So obviously the urban low would be a preliminary plat, and that goes through the hearing examiner, and then a site development permit, and CEPA would be done for all of that. For the neighborhood commercial, for portions that might be considered to be just commercial, solely commercial uses, could go through a binding site plan process, and then a depending on if they're multifamily or if there's a subdivision to get individual lots, would depend on what process in the development phase.
But is it's fair to assume that the reason for you as a company to come before us today and moving forward, I'm sure we see you again in this process, but is that the rezone in theory should provide the development with permitted uses. Is that a fair statement that the kind of the layout you have now?
Yes, there will be a number of permitted uses that are just outright allowed. Now, that having been said, Kitsap County currently is going through a change of the use table, and that's I can't guarantee what uses will be what at the end of that process either.
Yeah, other than that, and obviously speaking from a seat where somebody makes a living when things like this work, myself personally, but I think I would agree with Ms. Allen in regard to the comments about setbacks adjacent to the mine, and it may help your cause to know how those streams continue and terminate and what those setbacks from those streams for the mining folks looks like, just to help you graphically with the cause of discussions about buffer. And I only bring it up in the sense that we've sat here before with discussions up by Pendergast and neighborhoods adjacent mines, and this room gets very, very full when we talk about houses next to mining.
And we had that in last year's comp plan amendment process. And you know, as a couple of you have pointed out already, what's in front of us right now is the land use change.
Right.
And it's very easy to look at a conceptual plan like this and start to conflate what are the buffering issues and what are the setbacks and all that that might be addressed in a site-specific proposal. I would urge you to keep in mind that we could make the land use change and it gets adopted, and then the project for some reason could fall apart, or they sell it off or something else, and it could look nothing like this,
right,
built under the land use change. So we have to kind of keep that in mind too, and I'm not trying to scuttle your project by any stretch of the imagination, but that's kind of the reality of the change of land use and then getting into the site specific design issues.
Right.
But one of the elements that we as a planning commission can and should consider in the rezone is the compatibility with the new zoning designation with the existing surrounding zoning.
Absolutely. And you were correct when you stated earlier, this is a little bit of a mix of everything around this area.
I think that, I don't know the exact code reference, but it's either a 25 or 50 foot buffer between residential and industrial zones. And then in addition to that, and I appreciate your comment, Dave, part of why we didn't put lots and buildings and things on here is to try and stay at the conceptual phase, because this is not the project specific and don't want to get too far into that. But just wanted to see, well, what was the big site? What is it? What could it even mean? And then another thing, I'm happy to put an exhibit just with the county map of mapped critical areas and streams, but I, just being a developer myself, I don't ever want to visually represent a stream other than that on somebody else's property in a public meeting, just because I wouldn't want them to do that to me when I haven't actually been on their site and field verified that, but I'm happy to put whatever's on the county website, you know, on there just to kind of see what's out.
Yeah, and maybe we can request from staff that they overlay the critical areas on here from the county map.
You won't have to do it. We'll provide that.
thank you for
to address the noise concern. Something that that I've done through my work, and I'm obviously not shopping our services in this context, but just as an example of what could potentially be done, is I'm currently working with a city who they're doing a similar project. They're taking an old mine and reclaiming it to become kind of a mixed-use residential urban center kind of development. And so we've been working with them to peer review, as the developer has hired noise consultants to really look at the effects of the mine reclamation process on the surrounding properties from a noise perspective. So it's definitely something that the county could require that the developer look into as they're, you know, firming up the plan to say, okay, we need you to do noise monitoring while the mine is in use on a, you know, 7 o'clock on a Wednesday morning or whatever, and really come up with, you know, do some modeling to come up with the exact size of berm that would be required or something like that, depending how the county code includes that sort of option. But I would think that it would be easy enough to protect the future residents from noise concerns during the development process.
Right. Yeah, and all of us that have been here long enough recall these conversations on a site-specific last year exactly because of that. So, but again, for tonight and us going on 3 hours, I think, thank you for the reminder that that is chronologically down the road, and just to remember it moving forward, but for all of us to review adjacencies and related uses, and I guess just, you know, address it in that context. There's no denial that what Levi's company does is a part of definitely what's needed in the county, you know. And so our job, I think, for now is just looking at, does it fit, or do we need to start looking at how we're changing the fact that people like Levi's company are having trouble finding land.
Peter, do you have the zoning map, the existing zoning?
Yep.
So, yeah, this was not as far as I thought it might be, but if you go out a little farther, one thing just to keep in mind, currently the site's zoned industrial, and it abuts residential zoning. So this could be redeveloped in its current state as an industrial project, and it would be right next to urban residential. So we're just kind of moving that line back. Also in my application, I can bring it to the public meeting, kind of presented examples of, I don't know, 10 or so other locations in Kitsap County where industrial is either entirely or almost entirely surrounding residential or vice versa, and that's part of why the code has the footnotes that we all love to try and work through some of those compatibility issues during the development process.
Yeah. What he just referenced is an exhibit to the SEPA checklist. Okay. And that's available on the website.
Great. Yeah, because it's been drilled into our head in the back and forth with DCD over my whatever it is, 4 or 5 years here, that we really try not to create islands of zoning. But at the same time, when you think about this schematic site plan, it makes sense in the context of the development. So we have to be careful to not draw lines that can't be massaged.
So the particular portion of the January 7th hearing dealing with this project will be a quasi-judicial hearing. Is that correct?
Well, the whole hearing.
Comprehensive plan amendments are not site-specific. Only the site-specific ones are quasi-judicial.
No, they're all be the same. Because it's a...
Yeah. Well, I just want just the caveat that for this particular hearing, anyone associated with the applicant or the applicant's company were under the cone of silence and are now permitted to communicate pending that hearing.
It's clear that there are other non-residential uses in the vicinity, but I'm a little intrigued by the idea of establishing significant nodes of neighborhood commercial in an area like this where they're not really contiguous with other similar uses. We're kind of, the term spot zone almost comes to mind, because there's no other, retail neighborhood commercial type zoning anywhere near this, is there?
I guess what I'd say is there's not neighborhood commercial nearby, but if you go out to the intersection of Newberry Hill and Dickey Road, there are some commercial uses around there that are within the industrial zone. And in the industrial zone, there's a variety of commercial and industrial uses that are allowed.
So the staff isn't concerned that this will establish a precedent that might be problematic in other situations?
I think there's a variety of things to think about with this proposal. Spot zoning for a site this large with industrial adjacent to commercial is not one that I'm particularly concerned about. Compatibility of uses, I think, as many of you have mentioned, is something to really think about in what mitigation measures could address some of those things.
Isn't there almost a presumption, though, that neighborhood commercial is compatible with residential to some extent? I mean, certainly you have the conditions to impose conditions to make that so, but it's intended to be a commercial that's accessed by the surrounding residential.
It's actually
and serve those neighborhoods, right?
Okay. Yes, its purpose statement is for nearby use. Okay.
We look forward to the staff report.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you guys for staying late.
Yeah. All right. I see Richard pacing around outside. I think he wanted to come back in.
Yeah.
I thought he wanted to come back in for the end, but we'll Nope. Okay. Well, then we will move on. Is there anything else on the topic of the comprehensive plan amendments?
Nope. Right.
We're good. Thank you for a very comprehensive and thorough presentation. Okay, moving on. Mr. Ward, any administrative updates?
I yield my time to Angie Silva.
For the record, Angie Silva, a new assistant director for the Kitsap County Department of Community Development. So probably about 7 weeks in a current role. I know it's late and everybody wants to get home, so I will keep this very short and move more formal department updates in the new year. But with that said, again, I want to say thank you for taking the time here to be here. I know you're all volunteers. Working through land use and development issues is not easy. It's extremely complex. A lot of passion is thrown out when we come to these topics. So again, taking the time and energy on forums like this, but off the clock, getting prepped for those work studies as well as hearings, I just want to say thank you very much. Little background on me quickly before we leave for the evening. I'm a 15-year county employee. I started in the Department of Community Development, moved up to the commissioner's office, spent 13 years up there as a senior policy advisor. So now coming back home within the planning realm. So again, look forward to working with you. Many topics to come in the upcoming year as well as the 2019 docket.
Good.
Thank you.
All right. So moving on, and welcome. And we look forward to working with you and getting to know you as we go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Is there anything else for the good of the order? Hearing none, we will adjourn.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.